A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 11, 1988, entitled, Remembering, the Foundation of Hope. The scripture readings are Psalm 78, verses 1 through 39, and Deuteronomy 16, verses 1 through 17. The text for the sermon is Psalm 78, verses 2 through 6. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, this is your lucky day because on my desk at home is a stack of books I meant to bring with me and I forgot them. And you're lucky because I could have gone on no end with those books in my hand, but now I'll just have to make something up. One of the books was written by Carl Sagan, the great astronomer who wrote the book Cosmos, and it's been put on tape, and perhaps you've seen that series on public broadcasting, a marvelous series about the history of the universe and an exploration into the depths of space. When Sagan is a scientist, he's great, and as a communicator, he is unsurpassed. His problem is he also becomes a theologian, a philosopher, and a religious person. And then, as though on the same authority as his scientific research, he begins to make religious and philosophical and theological statements. And there, he's wrong. There, someone has to stand up and say, no, Sagan says. In the last paragraph of the book. So, consciousness on this planet has come to us. We are the expression of self-consciousness as it has evolved through the cosmos. We speak for planet Earth. Well, that's quite something. In fact, that's unmitigated arrogance. But Sagan's position is there's no God, no creator, no creative purpose, no mind, no loving design, a spontaneous, natural process of, as he would say, billions of years. And here we are, the highest expression, started out in some kind of a thin cosmic broth. When a cell suddenly was able to replicate itself, and through the sieve of natural selection, the cells that most satisfactorily replicated themselves became more and more complex beings until, here we are, folks, we're it. One of the other books is by Stephen Hawking, the Einstein of today, we're told. A severely handicapped, absolutely brilliant British astrophysicist who, like Carl Sagan, would speak of the Big Bang, which started it all off, but who says, not as a believer or a Christian, let me be honest at that point, but who says as a scientist, the bang could have been as well because a creator said bang as through whatever other speculative reason one might surmise. Now, Alan Bloom wrote a book, The Closing of the American Mind. He was a professor at Cornell where Sagan teaches, and in the 60s, he was so fed up with it. Because when the students rioted and took over the campus, there were not the resources within the academy to stand up to that mindlessness and say no. And Alan Bloom says that the malaise of society today can be laid at the foot of a university system that has had one axiom that everything is relative. Now, if Sagan's right, and there's no God, no creator, If we are the highest expression of what has evolved thus far, then if there ever will be anything like absolute truth or goodness or beauty, it's before us. It's beyond us. And to this point, one thing is as good as another. When you think deeply and long enough about it, without God, without some source of reality, without some ground of truth, without some standard of beauty, without some discriminating standard to differentiate between good and evil, without that, that is beyond us, all you have is what comes from within us. And then what I think is as good as what you think. I like Bach. You like heavy metal. Just a matter of taste? I hope not. But that's what you get down to when a society and a culture loses its rootage in the tradition that has shaped it. The whole of Western civilization finds its roots in Israel, in Greece, and in Rome. Biblical story, philosophical tradition, ideas of government and law and justice, deeply rooted in Western tradition, passed along the generations, always changing as history moves, but always changing according to a certain generally assented to set of norms and standards. And Alan Bloom says, we're raising a whole generation that will not be able to discriminate between truth and error, good and evil, beauty and ugliness, because no one has ever inculcated into them the norm, the standard. One who is exposed to a standard might reject the standard, but at least that rejection will be on the basis of some knowledge and understanding. But if there is no rootage in any tradition, then who determines if something is true or false, good or evil, beautiful or ugly? If relativism rules, then it's whatever feels good, whatever turns you on, then it's just a matter of taste. Now that's serious. And in the Old Testament, one of the things they were very clear about was that it ought not to be left to a matter of chance as to whether or not the rising generation had an opportunity to make an intelligent response to the truth as Israel understood it. And so, we had Psalm 78 that we read responsively, where it says, these things God commanded fathers to teach their children, so that the children might in turn teach their children, in order that the generation yet unborn might come to fix their hope in God. It is in the story that has made us what we are that we find the foundation for the hope of what yet will be. And any generation that loses its rootage in the tradition will be a generation that has not the wherewithal to decide intelligently, reasonably, for good or for ill. And so this morning I am I am tempted to become an old-time preacher and fall into the trap of the tyranny of the ought and stand up here and harangue you for 30 minutes about you ought, you must, you do. Oh, but I won't do that. No applause, please. But I want to suggest that as a new church year rises before us, there are many wonderful opportunities, and I want to challenge every one of you to find some place at which to plug in and to grow, to deepen, to gain understanding, to broaden the insight, in order that as a people we may know ourselves and that we may be able to keep the story alive. Oh, C.S. Lewis in his wonderful Screwtape Letters. Screwtape is the old devil, you know, and he's got a young nephew to whom he writes, and he helps his young nephew Wormwood with the ways in which to seduce the human race. And Screwtape says, "Now, work on people's distaste or their horror for the same old thing." Like the little kid came home from Sunday school and his mother said, "What did you learn in Sunday school?" And he said, "Oh, same old Jesus, you know." Kind of work at him. Get him bored with it all. The same old thing. But then Screwtape says, "But you know, God's wise, because what he has done is created a kind of rhythm in life so that as the year goes through its cycle, there is the satisfying of that desire for what is new balanced with a desire for what is permanent. So as you go through the cycle, it's the same old thing, but never the same, always new. And you move from feast, from fast, to feast, from fast, to feast through the cycle." Like the Old Testament. Every male in Judaism had to go to Jerusalem to the temple for the Feast of Unleavened Bread and for the Feast of Weeks and the Feast of Booths and three times a year present themselves before the Lord, and they kind of move from spring to fall and the rhythm of life and the rhythm of nature. All of that helped them to sense where they were in the totality of reality in relationship to God. And so in the Christian church, this is not a Sunday on the Christian calendar. This is just where we start churning the engines again here in a church year. Nonetheless, it comes around this time of year, every year. And there's something that's the same about it. And there's a lot that's brand new. But it's in the rhythm of life that we are able to continue to keep that growing edge. C.S. Lewis, in his letters to Malcolm, says it's important that there are particular days and holy places and holy times. If you just say, everything is God, before long, everything becomes blah, and you lose it all. And he said, you know, when you do these things, these religious duties, when we go through our rites and our rituals, he says, it's like an orchestra tuning up. Go in the orchestra hall, you hear all of these strange sounds, everybody's tuning their instrument. He said, that's all promise. That's not performance. But then, when the conductor raises his baton, then the symphony comes with all of its beautiful harmony. And so are religious rites and rituals. We come to the Lord's Supper, and maybe I spill the cup. We come to baptize an infant, and maybe Raj forgot to put water in the shell. We sing a hymn afterwards, and out of habit, half of you may stand up, even though the bulletin says stay seated. I mean, we mess it up. Nothing's perfect. But all we do is a sign that points beyond what we're doing. Everything that we do in this rhythm of life, in these rituals and these rites and these ceremonies, every seventh day coming into the house of God, all of that is like C.S. Lewis says, digging channels in the waterless desert so that we'll be ready if the water should flow. Now, when the water flows and there's been no working at it in the meantime, the water will spill off like water off a duck's back. But religious rites, religious duties, Lewis says, are often more duty than delight. But the point is, there is no delight without duty. And you know, God hasn't promised us a rose garden. You can't just go through life never struggling, never wrestling, with no discipline, thought, reflection, study, and expect that there will be any kind of depth at all in which to be fully human and fully alive. And so there's all kinds of structures and forms and opportunities, and they're of varying value, and we do it with varying degrees of finesse, but they're all there in order to enable a person to appropriate the water of the Spirit of God as it flows from time to time. 2 weeks ago, when I wasn't here, I was not far away. I was just up in Muskegon Heights at the Covenant Community Reformed Church, where I baptized my youngest grandchild, Sarah Grace. And that, of course, is a marvelous privilege and opportunity. And the Covenant Church is a small church. We could get it all into about 1.5 of these sections, and it's like an extended family. And they do their baptisms in a very wonderful, rich way. David and Lori took their little girls into their arms and came to the pulpit, and they read the vows that they themselves had written, speaking them to Sarah. Now, if you don't think that moved old Grandpa, then you don't know me very well. There they were. They were saying the things to Sarah that, with all my heart, I hoped and prayed they would be saying to Sarah. And then I got to baptize Sarah. And I made it through. I really did. And then they took their little girls and they walked up the aisle, and down the aisle, and up the aisle. And people got up and they gave them a hug and they kissed the baby. And it was warm, you know. You just kind of got moist around the eyeballs. And it was beautiful, beautiful. The family of God. And I sat there glowing. And then, as they came down the aisle, there was a couple sitting right here. Herman Kreisinger, brother of Dick Kreisinger of this congregation, who passed away a couple years ago. And Uncle Herman had been in the hospital that week. Uncle Herman has become an old man. He's feeble now. And it's obvious that when he walked through the door, I couldn't believe that he was able to be there that Sunday. And he sat in the pew, and as David and Lori came down with the baby, his wife Dorothy got up and went to the aisle, and she kissed the baby. But Herman couldn't get up. And I saw David whisper into Lori's ear. So Lori came down the aisle, down the front, up the aisle, into the pew, and handed the baby to Herman. Now, I got through the baptism, but I lost it there. Absolutely lost it. Because for me it was so personal, because I thought about Dick Kreisinger, who was like a surrogate father to me, who was a pillar in this congregation, who gave his all for the renewal of this congregation. And I saw old Herman, and because of Herman, who stayed right there in the Heights and stayed in that community and stayed with that church and stayed with that congregation and was one of its central pillars, here this old man, still there, holding the youngest child of the family. And I thought, that's what it's all about. That's all there is. That's what it's all about. With that kind of commitment, the story will go on until that day when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our God, and all God's children are whole. Thanks be to God.